I was at this entrepreneur event, and this woman, she's like, look, I don't have time to sit down and write. And I tried it already. I hated it. The process makes no sense. She's like, how do I get this book out of my head without doing that?
Right. I think a lot of people want that, right?
Right. And I looked at her. I'm like, are you asking me how to write a book without writing it? And she's like, yeah, kind of. And so like, I got like a little bit offended, right? Because here I am. This
my craft. Yeah.
I'm this fancy writer. Exactly. And so I got a little bit offended and I started lecturing her about hard work. And she like rolled her eyes and she's like, this is an entrepreneur event, right? I'm like, yeah. She's like, are you an entrepreneur? I said, yeah, of course. She's like, no, I don't think so. Because a real entrepreneur would help me solve my problem and not lecture me about hard work.
What wonderful advice, and also a little offensive, I'm sure, for you at the time, right?
But that was one of those gut punches where it was like, I had nothing to say because she was right.
You're listening to Business Lunch with Roland Frazier. This is your seat at the table. Hey friend, welcome to the show. Today, Roland is talking with Tucker Max, and this is a great story of someone with a unique talent that launched a super successful career. But around the 20-minute mark, you'll hear the shift where Tucker discovered something that led to a brilliant business idea that opened up the door to a different kind of success.
So Roland Frazier with Business Lunch, and in this case, it's early morning red wine drinking.
Purple coffee.
In
honor of Roy H. Williams.
As Roy H. Williams calls it. That's right. And I'm sitting here with Tucker Max and actually Todd Herman, who we just had a great chat with. And as it turns out, we are drinking a bottle of 1966 Chateau Petrus. And we could talk about wine pretty much this whole time.
We almost should do two podcasts, the business podcast and the wine podcast.
Yeah. I like that. So you've had some pretty cool pivots even since I've known you.
Yeah.
So I'd love to like kind of start before you got into writing and creating the cool genre that you wrote. I'm sure there'll be a blurb up, but for those of you who don't know, you are now a four-time
New York Times
bestseller,
about
to be six with a couple of new books that I know that are coming out.
Yeah.
And also hold, I think, the record with, like, is it only three other people that have had
Malcolm Gladwell and Michael Lewis are the only ones that have three nonfiction books on the list.
So you may know a thing or two about this writing.
Let's hope.
And you also have a business now
yes.
that used to be called Book in the Box, which you recently rebranded as Scribe, which
right.
is brilliant. And you've published over 1,000
mm-hmm.
authors. Awesome. So before you created, it was Fratire, right? Fraternity satire that they said.
Yeah, the New York Times called it that. Not me. I was not in a fraternity, nor is my stuff satire.
Right.
So I was like, how does this make sense?
Ribald tales of
they've
fun
been
adventures.
Fake news long before they were fake news.
Right, yeah. right. So before that, what were you doing? And then how did you get into writing that stuff?
I went to the University of Chicago. I thought, well, social life doesn't matter. I'll go to any school. I can make social life anywhere, right? Which was 100% wrong. And then,
were you a super outgoing person?
I'm definitely not an introvert.
Right.
And you think I'm laughing or I'm exaggerating? I'm not. At about 18, I thought I was the smartest person on earth. And so my thought process is I'll go to the hardest undergrad and let's see. Like, I'll show them how smart I am.
Nice.
And so I went to the University of Chicago because it's like, you know, it's up there with undergrad-wise, one of the two or three hardest. And then I'm like, well, let's major in econ because at the time there were five Nobel laureates there, right? Like Robert Coase, Fogel, Lucas, Becker, all those guys were there.
So you were mindful of that when you chose that?
Yes, 100%. Right.
Okay.
Like I'm going to go study with the guys who literally invented the field. It's called Chicago School Economics.
Right.
Like these are the guys who invented the field.
Interesting.
And they were still alive at the time. Like a bunch of them are dead now. But and so I got there and I realized a couple things really fast. Social life matters a lot. There was zero at that school.
Does everybody head down?
You know that everyone goes to high school with the nerdy chess club, doesn't talk to anyone, just does their work.
That's who was at Chicago?
That was all of them. All of them in the country went to college with me. And then I show up.
Sounds fun.
And I'm like an athlete and like not really, not a meathead, obviously, because I got in there and I was obviously very smart, or I did well enough on tests, right, mm-hmm. and all that stuff. I mean, but like I got in there and it was like, okay, like I remember being a freshman. I'll never forget this. A week into my freshman year, and I have my entire dorm in my room, like impromptu party. And I like had like a little bit of beer and this and that and whatever. And like everyone was like in my room partying. And like I was like the most popular dude in my entire dorm. Like, this doesn't feel like it should be this way. This
They're like alcohol right. and girls.
Like I was just beginning to show the shreds of self-awareness where I was like, maybe if I'm the most popular person in my dorm, something's not right here. You know, because most of me was like, oh, of course I'm the most popular person. Awesome. I'm amazing.
Right, right.
But then I was like, hold on a minute. Right. And little did I know that shred of self-awareness became painfully obvious over the next few months that it was a hell of social life-wise.
Right.
It was hell. So I got an academic scholarship to law school. I went to Duke for law school. That's why I went to Duke. I got into some better schools, but they gave me money, and I was like, okay, let's go.
Money's good.
Yes. And then I visited Duke, and Duke is terrible. But I went 15 minutes down the road to Chapel Hill, and UNC is just it's like 65%, 70% girls there.
It is, yes.
And like all the dudes are these foppish-haired, like frat boys, and they're all doofuses, and they think they're awesome because there's like the ratio's off. So right. they have this weird local maximum where they think they're cool, they but they're zeros.
Yeah, yeah.
And I walked in, I'll never forget, I went to some bar on Franklin Street, and I'm like, why are all, is this ladies' night? Like, why are all these so many girls here? And the guy looked at me like, no, dude, this is like what it's like. And I was like, I felt like a wolf who had found his way into a petting zoo. Duke. I was like, this is amazing. And so I was like, okay, I'm coming here. This is great. And so, I mean, you went to law school too, Roland. You, I'm sure you figured out the game. Like, I, that's why I always say people like, oh, you must be smart. I'm like, not really. Like, I am, yeah, of course, but there's way, way more people that are way smarter than me. What I figured out about school early on is that it is a system that you can game.
Yes, it is.
And once I figured out how to game the system, then it was like, I was like, oh, this is a joke. Law school is actually, it's funny, the higher up you go and the better the school and the more advanced the degree, the easier the system is to game, actually.
How did you game law school?
So law school, the basic way I gamed law school is the way everyone does it, right? Which is you realize you don't have to go to class because they never take attendance and the professors don't even care who's there. All you really have to do is just read about 2 weeks before the, because your entire grade is the exam. So you just read the textbook straight through. So you just read it straight through and that's it. And then like, okay, I get it. Like once you learn the principles, it's not that even hard. It's just rigorous thought. It's just questioning axioms, principles, things like that. That's it.
And now, so my hack for law school was I found out, because I got marketing for bar review courses right as I went in.
Oh, and, you did bar review first?
And we had,
yeah, that's like brilliant.
That? And we had all these cases to read. And I was like, man, this is like thousands of pages of cases that I have to read. And then from the cases, you're supposed to extrapolate these rules that apply. And then, and so they're not telling you it's breaking and everything, blah, 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 blah. Right. So I realized about a month in, I was like, I just went and signed up for the bar review course. And now I've got outlines of all the freaking rules as you have to take for the bar. Right. And so now I'm just arguing those things and it saved me this insane amount of reading.
This podcast is proof. Why I tell people you are way smarter than they are. Whoever
that was like, I was like, oh my God, this is the best breakthrough ever.
Dude, I people who know you, I always judge them by how quickly they realize you're smarter than they are. Did you know it in 5 minutes or did it take you a few weeks?
That's funny.
Like, I did not.
So you've hacked law school now and you're there and you have, you're at a more socially friendly and,
environment
and target rich environment, right?
I was the worst kind of idiot because I knew nothing, but I thought I knew everything. Right.
Fantastic.
So I had no idea what the world was like or what practicing law.
I think that's what it's like to be in your 20s.
I think I was worse than most. Yes, I agree. But I was worse than most. But I realized you didn't have to go to law, like you didn't have to go to class. Mm. I'm like, well, why am I even in Durham? Like, I don't need to even be here physically. And so I
just fly in for the
exams. No. So what I realized was, well, of course, like, well, where does everyone go? And like, I sleep with a lot of girls and drink a lot in Chapel Hill, but that party ends, right? Where do parties not end? And I'm like, oh, what about Cancun? And like in the spring,
it's like advanced party.
February, March, it's basically 2 full months of spring break.
Uh-huh.
What if I just lived in Cancun this whole 2 months? And like, wait, but I'm poor. Okay, what if I work down there? Then I can get paid to get drunk and hook up with girls. I'm like, that's the greatest idea of all time. And so I did a bunch of research. I figured out Student Express, I think, was the company I worked for. And I got on with them, and they paid my room and board. And literally every night, my job was to go to the clubs and make sure that our kids, like, don't die at the clubs that we shipped in. And like, it was dude, I got paid. And you have, like, when you're on-site staff, when you work on the island, you get this badge. It's like, because you got a shirt that says, like, whatever it is, like a guide or staff on the back. And, like, people treat you like you're a god, especially the students. It was the greatest 2 months of my life. It was like being a rock star almost, right? And anyway, so then I went back, and of course people found out, and the Adidas students was all upset. She's like, where have you been for 2 months? And I'm like, I was in Cancun. And this is before social media, so it was more like gossip, you know? But and she's like, she didn't even believe me. And then, of course, like an idiot, I showed her pictures. And then there was like this whole this whole thing about whether I would graduate. And then I was like, I have a 3.2.
Right.
And like, so, you know, what's funny is that whole thing, plus me writing about it a few years later, like when I wrote my books and my blog, which mm-hmm. I'll talk about in a minute. There is now what you and I experienced, the no attendance stuff, mm-hmm. that, you know, that's changed, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Like to be ABA accredited now.
They make you sign in every class with a signature.
Do.
Yeah.
Do you know why?
I don't.
One of the junior ABA members went to law school with me, who's on like the committee or whatever. And he goes, yeah, dude, we called this the Tucker Max rule. <That's> Seriously, awesome. If you, cool. everyone now who goes to law school has to sign in and be there because of me.
That's awesome.
Like no one, everyone knew that this happened. No one cared until someone made it public. I made it public and they're like, we can't have this anymore.
That's funny.
Change the rule. The Tucker Max rule.
That's something to be proud of. That's a legacy.
I know. So anyway, so after law school, we all went to different cities. Oh, and then I should mention this. You know, we all do internships 2L a year, right? Yeah. In between your 2 and 3L year, you pick a firm, you interview one or two, and then you know they pay you a ridiculous sum of money, you know, $1,500, $2,000 a week or whatever your first year salary would be. And then the job, the basic thing is they're trying to recruit you, right? And so I went to Fenwick & West, which is, you know, a big firm. They represent Google and Yahoo and, you know, and Amazon and all these people. And they're the biggest or the second biggest firm in Silicon Valley. And they fired me within 3 weeks of me being there. And like, it is impossible to get fired as a summer associate. Right. No one wants to fire summer associates because no firm wants to get the reputation for like, you know, firing summer associates.
Sure.
3 weeks is all. Now, if you don't get an offer from a firm, that's really bad. To get fired is unheard of. I got fired in 3 weeks. Shockingly, I get no other offers from law firm. And so I go to work for my dad who owns a bunch of restaurants in South Florida. Then my dad fires me from the family business. Like, my name's on the door. The restaurants are called Max's Grill. And then, so I didn't really know what to do at that point. I was, like, kind of bummed because the two things I trained for, law and business, I had not just failed at, but been fired from. Once by a firm that doesn't fire people, and then another by your own family. So my friends were all working in different firms around the country. And so I was very depressed, but I would write emails to my friends about all the dumb things I was doing. And my friends thought these were the funniest things of all time. And so one day, one of my friends calls me. He's actually a senior editor now at Real Clear Politics, this guy. And he says, Tucker, not so good at law, not so good at business, but you your emails are really funny. Like, this is what you should do.
Hmm.
And I'm like, be a writer? Mm-hmm. I'm not a bitch. What's wrong with you, right? And he's like, well, you're not good at anything else, dude. So maybe being a bitch is what you should do. And so I tried to get my – so I took like 6 or 10 of my best emails to my friends, cleaned them up a little. And so I'm sending out drunken revelry stories to publishers and agents. And so they did not – you know, I got zero interest. And when I say zero, I mean literally like not – you know, 90, I sent, I'm not kidding, at least probably 1,000 query letters. This is back when publishing was big, before really the internet took over. So I probably sent, there were, who knows, hundreds of publishers, maybe multiple hundreds of agents. Every person I could get an address for, there's a big book of it that used to have all the names.
That's what I did. I want to do that, yeah.
And I sent
out all your query letters.
I sent queries to every single one, and 95% no response. And most of the responses, the negative responses were form letters.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were like 3 or 4 that like took time to do personalized rejection letters that were like, this is the worst thing I've ever read.
We really want you to understand why we're not going to.
I want you to never write again, not even an email.
Right.
Like it was like, I got 3 or 4 of those. But here's what was going on. At the time, I had been sending these emails to my friends. And then my friends, you guys remember email forwards like back, like this is before MySpace. MySpace started in 04. So this is a long time ago. My friends were forwarding my emails to other people, like at their firm or their social circles or who they went to college with. I started getting my emails forwarded back to me from people in other social circles.
They're like, this is cool guy. You should listen to. Yeah.
No, I'm not even kidding.
How freaking cool is
that? A dude I went to high school with forwarded me one of my emails. It's the first story in my first book, the Sushi Pants story. It's like one of my famous ones. It's still on the internet. You can Google it.
Sushi Pants story,
and it'll be
that
the first,
just sounds it, interesting right off the bat.
So he emails it to me. So he goes, dude, did you read this? Or you should read this. This sounds like you. And I wrote him back. I'm like, look at the first header. Look at the name of the person who wrote it. That, I did write. That is me. He's like, oh, no wonder. That's so funny. That was when I knew, okay, I got something. Like, I don't care what these people who've dedicated their lives to picking the right books to publish. They don't know anything.
Right.
I must be right because, like, people are forwarding this back to me. And I wish I could tell you that, like, this was, like, a rational, but it was mainly just hubris.
But something clicked with you at that point.
No, right? It did. It really did. That was one of those where I was like, this is, if I knew what product market fit was at the time, I would have been like, this is product market fit. I've nailed it. There was virality before people understood what virality was.
So how did that change what you did to, because you've, at this point, you've been rejected by effectively 1,000 people, right, for this?
So what I did was, by then it was early 02. And there's strange, weird place where a bunch of kooks hung out called the internet was becoming a big thing. And this is where GeoCities was around then. And so I was like, all right, I'll just put my writing up on the internet. What else am I going to do with
it? So at that time, you created a weblog.
Yes. No, weblog, the word weblog did not exist. I believe that came around in 03.
Okay. All right.
So I had to learn to code HTML.
Yeah.
I'm not even.
It was freaking hard back then.
Yeah, I had to code HTML. Yeah. And so I put it on this site called, or I submitted it to two sites. One called Board at Work, which I think still exists, but it was big at the time. And they published links to all my stories and then blew up. And then I submitted my stuff to this site called College Humor, which is now massive.
They are
right?
Giant, yes.
And at the time, when they would post the daily link, they'd get 10 to 20,000, like, they'd refer out referrals, right? And then also this other place called FARC, which was huge at the time, not so big anymore, but Drew Curtis actually is a friend of mine. We went to high school together and didn't know each other.
I remember
like
all three of those.
Public school, not boarding school. Yeah. Anyway, so those three sites kind of caused my thing to blow up. And then an MTV producer emailed me and was like, we're doing a show about internet dating. We'd love to have you on it. Because I would write stories about the girls I'd meet. And I had this dating application on it where like girls could fill out an application and go date with me. It was a total joke. It was like, you know, like what are we going to do on our first date?
An application to date you.
I am absolutely serious. And like I would have like things where it was like, you could, you know, drop down menus. Like, what are we going to do on the first date? It's like, go to a gun range, pick up a stripper, you know, pick up a stripper and go to a gun range. It was like all these goofy, like the thing was ridiculous. They came and filmed me, and then it, like, kind of blew up. And then literally the next month, a girl that I wrote about sued me. And I use fake names for everybody in my stories except me because my theory was – or my idea was I choose to live my life in public. None of them do.
Yeah.
So, you know, I use pseudonyms, even forgetting the legal stuff. Like, but there was one person I did not use a pseudonym for because she was well-known, Miss Vermont. Her name is Katie Johnson. This is all in my second book and still on my site. But she won Miss Vermont, Miss USA, and Miss Vermont, Miss America, right? There's two different pageant tracks, and she won Miss Vermont for both. And so I wrote – so basically, we hooked up for about a month, and I wrote a story about everything we did. Then that was like – I put that up in November or something. And then in May, I get served.
He's got a lawsuit.
Served.
Nice.
Right? And you'll love this, Roland. So for the first time in American legal history, this was actually front page of New York Times, a judge had issued a prior restraint ruling against an internet website, mine. And so anyway, so this is like a major, like I call ACLU, I got plenty of lawyer friends, I get a New York Times reporter on this.
Yeah.
So long story short, I won the case, of course, won a runaway win. There's not even a debate. I think they ended up dropping it. And so I win, man, it's funny. It's like in the movie, that would be the thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Man, in real life, it was just like a more roller coaster.
You had your publishing thing.
What? No, because after the lawsuit was a big, big deal. This was one of the very first
media. Now you had earned media.
No, I had a lot of earned media.
Yes, yes.
And the MTV thing both.
Okay.
So I was like, you know, like
your name's out there.
It was a tempest in the teapot, but I took it and ran with it.
Yeah,
right. And I had a bunch of great stories. At that point, I had a website, right? And I had an email capture, which I didn't even understand email at the time at all.
So did your traffic, were you watching traffic on your website?
Oh, of course. Okay. Like a beast. I was one of the original content marketers, like in terms of put your best stuff out for free.
Right.
I had nowhere to publish. If I had been accepted into the, I tried to get published in magazines, books, anywhere. No one wanted me. So I had to put my stuff out for free, and I realized, oh, this is the best advertising I could ever have by accident, right? And the stuff I had for free then is still for free on my website.
Yep.
You can still read my very best stuff on my website, and I still sell, you know, 2,000-3,000 books a week.
Yeah. A lot of people do that, though. And it's just people like me who,
but no
who
one
don't
was,
have the time or at the time, no one listens to the audiobook this. Or, yeah. You know, I'll like it all in one place where I don't have to go for it. And that just totally makes sense.
At the time, no one was doing this, yes, though. This was revolutionary. Yes. Unheard of. And in fact, it was very low status. Mm-hmm. People said, oh, if your stuff's free, you're not a serious writer. Mm-hmm. And so I got it going, finally. So it was a long, hard journey. But basically, I just kept posting my stuff. Took about a year and a half, and my stuff really blew up on the internet. And so the publishers came back to me. Then I signed my book deal in 05 for nothing, $7,500 advance.
Okay.
And eventually I ended up going with one. His name's Jeremy Ruby Strauss. He's pretty well known. He's done tons and tons of books now. But anyway, so he and I worked together. We did I Hope They Serve Beer in Hell. It came out January 2006.
I just love this. Letting people hear this, and I don't know if you've talked about it before, but to me, it's really great because for anybody that wants to have any kind of success, it just doesn't. I mean, it rarely comes. I'm going to assume at some point somebody is blessed in a way that it does, but this is how it almost always is.
Yeah. So then the book comes out, and the asset that I had that I did not realize was so valuable was my email list. Like, I'm not like you and Perry and Ryan. Like, my mindset was not selling into this as an audience. Mm-hmm. My mindset was entertainer, right? So I was not anywhere near the business savvy I have now. And so book came out. I had about a 50, 60,000 person email list, which at the time was really like, I could have made so much money off that. Right. I had any brain at all, but I didn't. So book came out.
And people actually wanted email then. No, you got mail.
I sold 5,000 books the first week, which was amazing because I got literally zero press. No one cared about me. That's no one wrote insane, it. Like, yeah. I was... Like
you sold out of basically what's first printing for a lot of people.
And so hit the New York Times bestseller list, number 24 out of nowhere. Wow. Right?
Now, are you shocked at this point? You're like, holy crap. Or you're like, yeah.
I should have been shocked. Okay. I was arrogant enough where I thought I deserved it. Okay.
Right? All right, that's cool. That's
but fine. I should have been shocked. Yeah. 5,000 the first week, 3,500 the second week, 3,600 the second week, then like 2,000. And then as it kind of slowly went down and down and bottomed about 850, and then it started climbing. 900, 1100, 1200, 1300.
Are you promoting at this point?
I mean, my website's up. I'm still writing
but
new
nothing
stuff.
Different. Like, no. What caused it to take off after that was?
Word of mouth.
Yeah.
When you write something that is really good, that meets a need people have or solves a problem, they will tell other people. And I was a unique voice that said something that a lot of people were thinking and no one was saying. Mm-hmm. And I said it, I stood up and I said it with my real name, and I was just raw and pure and funny as hell. And I could tell you all the things I tried to do to market, and looking back now with actual experience, like if you'd interviewed me like in 2011, I would have told you all these things I did that I thought caused a success.
Yeah.
I think if anything, they hurt it, but probably had no effect.
Sure.
I did two things. I put it all up for free on the internet and I made it really good.
Right.
And that's it.
Right.
That's it. And everything else was like word of mouth and organic.
Nice.
That's it.
So you're a successful author at this point. What makes you think about helping other people write books?
Like, I wish I could tell you the story about how smart I was, but the truth is the opposite.
I can't tell you that story about myself either, or most people. So yeah,
the truth is the opposite, man. Like, here's what. Literally, as soon as I came out with a book, people started asking me, "Well, how'd you do that? How can I write a book?" And then
How could I write a book, or how can I write a New York Times bestseller?
Both. Okay. Both, but a huge portion of them really just wanted
to
write a
book. Just get
the word out. Yeah, but definitely both. And there's definitely the portion of people who want to buy. I want to the status. But I think a bigger portion who want to do the thing, you know? And so, Todd just left. He likes to say a lot of people want the noun without the verb, right? Mm-hmm. I want to be a New York Times bestselling author
way to say it.
Without actually doing the work of being it. Yeah. Yes. So,
I would like that also.
Yeah, wouldn't we all? Anyway, so for years people would ask me this, and I'm such a dumbass. The script I would say in my was the script that other people had put in my head, which is, well, here's how you become a writer, and you do this, and you have to struggle, but like that was the script of what you had to do.
It's also not terribly helpful, right? I mean,
exactly right.
People tell you that.
It's like
when you're like, how can I be successful? Is it find a need and fill it? What the hell does that mean? You know. So okay, go ahead.
So, but it's the script other people have said, and it was in my head, and I had never thought about it, so I just repeated it, especially because it did pretty much match my experience. And then I was at this entrepreneur event in 2013, and this woman same question. How do I write a book? And I kind of gave her the same answer. She's like, no, Seth. She was like, I don't want to hear your stuff about hard work. She's like, look, I have a really successful company. I got a family, in New York City. You know, well, I have too much stuff to do. I don't have time to sit down and write. And I tried it already. I hated it. The process makes no sense. She's like, how do I get this book out of my head without doing that?
Right. I think a lot of people want that, right?
Right. And I looked at her. I'm like, are you asking me how to write a book without writing it? And she's like, yeah, kind of. And so I got like a little bit offended, right? Because here I am this fancy
craft. Yeah.
I'm this fancy writer. Exactly. And so I got a little bit offended and I started lecturing her about hard work. And I gave her the Mark Cuban quote, everyone wants to be a star, but no one wants to go to the gym and all this sort of stuff. And she like rolled her eyes and she's like, this is an entrepreneur event, right? I'm like, yeah. She's like, are you an entrepreneur? I said, yeah, of course. She's like, no, I don't think so. Because a real entrepreneur would help me solve my problem and not lecture me about hard work.
What wonderful advice and also a little offensive, I'm sure, for you at the time, right?
But that was one of those gut punches where it was like, I had nothing to say because she was on a core level. She was right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Especially as an entrepreneur.
For sure.
You solve problems or you're not an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And so, I know. Her name's Melissa Gonzalez. She was our first client.
I like her,
She's great. We should get her in War Room, actually. You'd like her a lot.
I like her a lot already.
So I have no answer to it. And so then I become obsessed with this question, right? How do I do this? And I keep coming back to there's no way to do it, no way to. And then I didn't even remember what it was. You'll love this little detail, actually. I remember how I figured this out because it's so stupid, but it's how like connections work creatively. I was watching TV and Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure came on. Remember that movie?
It is a fantastic cinematic masterpiece. I love that
movie. It actually is a good movie,
man. I agree 100%.
It is an underrated movie.
It's actually quite smart, I think.
It is.
Yeah.
And then the scene with Socrates, but they call him Socrates,
yes,
right?
Of course.
And so I'm looking at that. I'm watching the scene. I'm laughing. Socrates is obsessed with whatever, like pretzels or chocolate. And then it hits me like, oh my God, of course. Like I read The Apology. Who wrote The Apology? Plato wrote The Apology, not Socrates. Yep. Socrates had a scribe. He didn't write anything down.
Right.
And I was like, oh my God, I'm such an idiot. So did Jesus. So did Buddha. So did Malcolm X. So did Marco Polo. So did Winston Churchill. Like, he was a great writer, but he used his secretary. He dictated to his secretary. So did Julius Caesar. And I'm like, oh my God. And so I call her up and I'm like, okay, I got it. Here's what we're going to do. I'm going to call you. I went to my whiteboard in my place. I wrote down every step to write a book, and I realized I only need her for the content.
Right.
It's a very important part of a book.
Yes.
But it is actually not even the majority. It's 40% of the book, right? It feels like 100% when you read it, but putting it together, it's not a small part. It is a crucial and large part, but not the biggest part. I'm like, okay. I'm going to call you when I need content. You're going to get on the phone. You're just going to answer my questions. You're going to follow my instructions.
And this is you calling her.
Yeah. I'm talking. And said, but here's the thing. I'm not, her field was like pop-up retail, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, we'll do this as a test. You can pay me 10 grand if it works. If it doesn't, it's free. Because this is like, I'm not envisioning this as a business. This is just a project. She challenged my manhood. It's like, I got to do this, right? That's the only reason I'm even doing this. And so I'm like, I don't think it's going to work. We'll test it. I'm not going to learn about pop-up retail. I'm not going to read one thing about it. Like, you have to know everything.
Yep.
You don't have to know anything about writing books, so
right.
I know that.
Yep.
And she's like, yes, that's exactly right. And she's like, but the big thing is it has to be my voice. I'm like, of course it's your voice. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to do this. It'll be in your voice. So she's like, okay, let's try it. And so I got my co-founder, Zach, to help me. He was like a freelancer, helped me on another project at the time. He was just a kick-ass kid who was doing amazing stuff. So he helped me. And then I actually got him to interview her a bunch because I wanted to see if it was me or him and whatever. We ended up producing a great book. And so like released it in like May of 2014. And it it did great. Like she's got this little
Are you book in a box at this point? Or are you just kind of thinking about
it? We are not
you're a
guy, thing at this
couple
point.
Of dudes helping somebody write a book.
Right. We are not even a business.
Right.
And so she starts referring people to us. So I start getting calls from people who are like, hey, can you do for me what you did for Melissa? And I'm like, who is this? Prank caller. Right. Like, why are you calling my phone?
Right.
And they're like, I'll pay you. And I'm like, what? And like, this happens like 3 or 4 times. And I'm like, Zach, do you want to handle this? He's like, yeah, great. I'll do it, sir. I'm like, okay, split the money with me. He's like, yeah, let's do it. So he does like 3 or 4 of those. And then I go on Lewis Howe's podcast. And this is kind of right when he started it, right? Mm-hmm. And he's interviewing me about a bunch of stuff. And that was when he was writing, he was having someone help him write School of Greatness. Mm-hmm. And Niels Parker, who's my good friend, was helping him, was his ghostwriter, basically. Mm-hmm. So Lewis was talking to me about the struggles he was having with his book. And, you know, because Lewis is very dyslexic. Mm-hmm. He can barely read. And so I'm like, oh, Lewis, dude, you should try this. And I told him what we had done for Melissa.
Right.
And he's like, that's an amazing idea. What do you call your company? And I was like, what? And this was like 6-8 months after Dick in a Box had come out. Uh-huh. Like, you know, the SNL skit.
With SNL skit, yeah.
Right. And so Zach and I had joked that, like, we were doing, you know, book as a service, or like we'd call Book in a Box. And so he asked what the company was called. And I was like, Book in a Box. Like, and Lewis was like, that's great. Everyone go to my friend's company, Book in a Box, whatever. And I'm like, okay, no one will listen to this podcast. Like this is like Lewis's third episode. Doesn't matter. I get an email the next day from somebody. Hey, I can't find anything on the internet about Book in a Box. Where can I sign up for this? And I write back, who is this? Because I knew the podcast wasn't out.
Break
right?
email.
Right. And the guy's like, oh, sorry, man. I'm Lewis's sound editor. This just sounds so interesting.
Well, that tells you something, doesn't it?
So I go to Zach. Finally, this is like the fifth thing, right?
All right.
And I go to Zach and I'm like, dude, I think we might have a business here. And Zach's like, you're an idiot. Of course we do. I'm already doing this. And then I was like, man, when people are trying to buy something that you're not selling, mm-hmm. maybe that's a good business.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I know that's really funny. All of you should be laughing at me right now.
Yes, 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 yes.
Because we put up a landing page. Lewis's podcast came out. My son was born July 30th, 2014. My dog, who was like my best friend on earth, sadly for a decade, died a week later. And Lewis's podcast came out a week after that. And we got $200,000 of business in 2 weeks off of that podcast. All at once, my life just went upside down.
Apparently, people do listen to podcasts also.
I know, shockingly. That's how we started, man. And like that was just off the races from there.
Awesome. So now, and since then, you've helped 1,000 people, I believe.
Do books, right?
Write books. So for the people that are out there, I know you have a talk and all that kind of stuff. Do you have like a webinar or something that people can go to that want to write a book to find out?
So now I have to do a webinar. Is that what you're saying?
No. I'm just like for right. people that are interested because we're not going to talk about it here.
Go to scribewriting.com/webinar. Scribe, S-C-R-I-B-E, writing, just the normal spelling of it, .com/webinar.
Okay.
And between the time we record this and it goes up, I will put up a webinar.
Oh, you are going to do it. Okay.
I
thought you were
not.
I like, no, okay, we have one here. Okay.
But we probably should.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because number one, it'll save you hours and hours because you're going to answer the same questions a million times, but it'll also help people that
I'm an entertainer. It's my job to repeat.
Cool. Okay. So now from the business side, now you're like, okay, we're going to do this. You put up your landing page, you get $200,000 business, and then happily ever after, easy breezy, no need to
Wouldn't
worry about
that be
anything?
Great, man. Oh, yeah, just let me go to my private jet now.
What happened? What are the challenges?
So we did great for the first that year. We did, I think we ended up doing, got $1 million in that the next 6 months or something.
Seven-figure business. Like it.
Yeah. It was maybe, I think we actually, no, we got to 750 that in the first 7 months and then $1.5 million in the first year.
Okay.
Yeah, there you go. So, and it was going great. It was me and Zach. And then we hired like an admin or two and we used freelancers and like, we were doing great until we got to about somewhere between 75 and 100.
Authors.
Yeah. We hit that about a year and a half in. It got hairy around 75, but the wheels came off at 200.
Okay.
And that was when we were about a year and a half, almost 2 years in, somewhere around there. And we were getting some baller. Like Todd Herman was an early client. He was like one of the first 40 people who signed.
Yeah. Right?
And so we had serious ballers.
Mm-hmm.
And so we couldn't be screwing this up. Like these weren't schlubs, right? And so we had this one guy. He was in Austin. And he ran this software company called Headspring, which was at the time doing like $20 million, $100 million valuation. It was, you know, enterprise B2B custom stuff. You know, 3M client, Koch Brothers, McCoy's. Yeah. They had some pretty big clients, right? And so he was a client. And he was like, you know, I went to his office to sell him and do a sales call and then – or sales thing. And then loved him. He was such a good dude. Charismatic, smart, cool. Like everything was dialed. Like I'm like, this is the type of CEO I want to be. And so on the way out, joking kind of, but not really. I said, hey, listen, his name is JT. I said, JT, I'll make sure your book's amazing. You got to help me with this CEO thing though. Like you got to help me. I want to get to where you are. And he looks at me real serious. He's like, you serious? Because I'll do it. And I'm like, yeah, man, of course.
I'll do it.
He goes, okay, man. Every time I have a contact with your company, I'm going to call you and tell you how it goes. I'm like, awesome. Thank you so much, right? And yeah, I mean, I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
But my assumption is, you know, like it'll be like everyone else.
Yeah.
Right? And a week later, I get a phone call. JT McCormick pops up on my phone. Like, oh, what's up, JT? He's like, awesome, man. How are you doing, Tucker? Blah. And he's like, all right, let me tell you, just had my onboarding call with your team. Here's three things you did right. Boom, boom, boom. I'm like, all right, we're doing great. Now, let's talk about what you can do better. And it was a list of like 50 things that were all gut-punchingly correct and brutal, but right. Yeah. And they were all, I was like, oh, yes. Oh, my God, yeah. And it was like, okay. And so then second call, same thing, right? And then I, like after that, I'm like, yo, you're in Austin. We just hired a GM to help Zach and I scale this, right? And this woman was senior manager at Blackboard Software, which is huge multi-billion-dollar software company or whatever. And like, you want to come to our executive meeting? Like, you want to be an advisor? And he's like, let me see. Maybe. Let me come to the meeting. So he comes to the meeting. By the end of the meeting, he was running the meeting. He was running good because he just knew what he was doing. Yeah, and we didn't, yeah. Right? And it was
leadership that comes that way is so obvious.
Right. Yeah. And it was like, okay, this is the guy. This is the guy. And so long, long story short, we ended up having to fire the disaster of a GM we hired. Mm-hmm. Nothing against her, but predictably a middle manager at a software, an old software company is not the right person to scale a fast growing startup.
Right.
Who would have ever guessed?
With fairly strong-minded founders.
Right, right, exactly. Also that part. And so JT, we get to know him really well. And he's like, all right. He's like, he was making $1 million a year at the time, mm-hmm. right? And with all incentives and everything. And I'm like, dude, when we get to 10 million, then we'll be ready to hire you. Because we're kind of talking about it. He goes, you're not going
to
make
it.
Going
to get to 10 million. That's what I was going to say.
It's like, you're not going to get there.
Right.
I'm like, we'll get there. And he goes, you don't even know what you don't know. Mm. And so we kind of like went back and forth, negotiated a deal. And he said, I'll tell you what, I'll come in as president and COO and you can say CEO. And that was like, that was the moment, man. Because it wasn't just hiring him. It was
which,
how he was going
to
come in.
Which actually is the right, he knew the right jobs to take because the CEO shouldn't do ops. The CEO is outward facing. You needed ops help.
We did.
Yeah.
But he wasn't just an ops CEO mm-hmm. or COO. That man, I knew, I could just the small team we had, they would follow him around like ducklings, dude. Like part of the CEO's job is not just setting, I can set vision all day. Mm-hmm. I'm actually amazing at that. I'm not a manager. I'm not a leader in terms of like day-to-day.
Culture and all that
right,
fun stuff.
Exactly. Yep. Like I can tell you this is the culture we need to have and I can yep. set the vision for yes. it, but I'm not the person that creates it, right? And JT is. And I'm like, no, man, you need to be the CEO. Because if we're going to do this, you're going to be the one doing all the CEO tasks except for vision setting and some outward-facing stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be fraudulent for me to have that role. I can still be outward-facing and I can still set vision from, you know, a chairman of the board or founder role, whatever we call it.
Yep.
But you need to be the one in the chair.
Nice.
And I battled with that for a couple weeks. It was mm-hmm. Because it was a very ego-based thing, man.
Sure.
But as soon as I made that decision, I felt it and I knew it. I knew it was right. So to give you guys, we were about 2.5 million, whatever, when he officially came on board. Mm-hmm. We just passed 20 million in sales.
Nice.
So he basically 10x'd the company in like 2.5 years. We had 150, 200 authors signed at the time and maybe 20 books out. We just published our 400th book and we have another 600-700 in process right now that are on the way, right? And or more. And we're over 1,000 that we've worked with. You know, and we have amazing, huge best-selling books and we're on a, you know, our trajectory. It's way the fuck up with help from friends of ours.
Yes.
But it's mainly because of him. That dude is like, our company is the definition of find amazing people and then get out of their way.
Super awesome. And you won some cultural award.
Oh, yeah, right.
Too, right.
Entrepreneur Magazine named us the top company culture in America for companies like under 100 or whatever. They have small, medium, large. We were number one for small.
Do you think you might ever aspire to win that from Fortune magazine?
Fortune put us number 20.
I know.
Those jerks. Yeah.
I like that. Okay. So so now you were crazy, have sex, party all the time kind of guy.
Yes.
And now you are married, family man, two kids, responsible. That's a pretty huge role change. But what was the change? What would you say?
I eventually got tired of drinking, hooking up, whoring around, all that stuff. I got tired of it and because at its core, it's ultimately both very selfish and very shallow and very meaningless. It's sort of like fast food, right?
Yeah.
Like, say what you want about McDonald's. You cannot say it's not delicious. Mm-hmm. That is the thing it is. It is engineered to be both delicious and cheap, right? Mm-hmm. Now, terrible for you and all the other sort of problems with it, right? But that's sort of like drinking, partying, hooking up. It is fun. That you say what you want about it, there is a level at which is very fun. McDonald's, it is delicious.
But if
right?
you eat it every day.
If you eat it every day, yeah. you get sick and die.
Yeah.
I think it's the same thing, man. And to be really frank and honest, a lot of any sort of extreme behavior is almost always sort of an adaptation to a way to deal with trauma and run from pain, mm-hmm. right? And so you can work too much, you can have too much sex, you can gamble, you can do drugs, you can or do all of those things. They're all a way to escape some sort of pain or issue that you won't face. And so as I got older, I realized that, right? Because the stuff I would do that worked when I was 21 and 22 worked less at 28 and didn't work at all at 34, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. 21, you got drinking, you're not sad and lonely anymore. At 34, it actually maybe makes it worse. You know what it was, man? When I started writing, I had a vision of success and I got 5 or 10x past it, right? Way more money, way more success than I ever could have imagined. And I wasn't any more happy. I wasn't less happy. Like, things were better. It's better to have money than not have
better
money.
To have money and be unhappy than right. not. Assuming you don't go down some bad tracks.
Well, the thing is, I wasn't even unhappy, mm-hmm. so to speak. I was
fulfilled.
I wasn't happy.
Yeah.
And I wasn't content. I wasn't mm-hmm. fulfilled. And I was still kind of sad and kind of not depressed, but just like, it wasn't right, you know? And so I was like, okay, if I have all this externally and I'm not happy, then I was like, okay, let me get my life right. So, like, you know, like, best shape ever, like, everything. Fix everything external there is to fix. And I was still, it was a little bit better, but mm-hmm. it was just incrementally better, right? Mm-hmm. Not way better. And I'm like, okay, then if everything in my life is amazing and I still kind of feel not good, it's got to be me. There's got to be something inside of me that's not right. And then that's when I started psychoanalysis. And I spent 4 years. It's a form of talk therapy. Yep. But I spent 4 years going 4 times a week. So, no, like, I was in. Like, I'm going to go. Mm-hmm. And then I paired it with meditation. And that worked really well for me.
Now, have you met your wife at this point? Or is this is the self-evolution discovery process?
Actually, that's not true. I met her about 3 years in.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so, do you feel comfortable sharing her name on...
Veronica, of course. Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. She has her own business. It's called the American Academy of Nurse Entrepreneurs. Like, she was a nurse practitioner, started her own medical company, and now she teaches nurses. She has that still, and then teaches nurses how to start their own practices. Okay.
So you're doing self-discovery now. Haven't yet met Veronica.
Right.
So you made a conscious decision then that you wanted to make a change?
Yeah.
Or you just met the right person? And
No. Okay. It was, for me, I had to make the decision before I would even be ready to meet her.
Okay.
Right? And that wasn't like a mystical universe thing. It was just clear the type of woman, my analyst was the one to help me work through this. The type of woman that I would want to meet.
Yeah, wouldn't be attracted to the you before. Yeah, I totally get that.
So what I had to do was I went through this whole process with her where she helped me understand, okay, who's the woman you want to date? Mm-hmm. And of course, I made a laundry list of everything she had to have. Right. And it was like
it's a British accent.
Dude, it was like it was like a 14-year-old girl list. Like, yeah. It was like 100 things long.
Yeah.
And my analyst, I'll never forget this. She looked at it and she's like, you know, she's like totally like plays her cards. Like, she could have been a world-class poker player. And she's like, okay, let me ask you something, Tucker. Is there a woman in existence that has all these things? I'm like, yeah, of course. And so she started reading them off. And I was like, all right. So I eventually paired her down to like 3 must-haves and 3 really nice to-haves, right?
And that's so, quite a pairing. That must have taken some time.
It did.
You're like, but I want the...
Yeah. What about this? And this is important. So, but then eventually it became like 3 must-haves, 3 nice-to-haves. And she's like, okay, is this a real... I'm like, yeah, that are rare, not easy to find, but that woman exists. Then she threw the total curveball at me. Would this woman be attracted to you? And of course, I'm like, yeah, she better be. I'm a baller. And she's like, well, hold on. Let's think about that. And then she started asking questions. And she's like, so when she meets you out and you have 3 women on you, what's she going to think? And I'm like, buffangulia. But that's her job. That's why I paid her, right? And so...
She sounds like she's actually really good at what she does.
She was very good. Yeah. And helped me realize, okay, part of me absolutely wanted to and was ready to meet that woman, but I hadn't really changed. I wasn't dating 3 women at the same time. And really, at that point, I was mm-hmm. past that stage. But I hadn't really evolved fully. I'd kind of stopped a lot of bad behaviors, but not brought in and set a new good ones, mm-hmm. right? And so then we went into, where is that woman, right? What does she do? Mm-hmm. And so I made a list of like 50 things that I could see that woman doing. And like, you know, 45 of them I didn't care about. But there were five that were like I was super into. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't doing any of those things.
Right.
Yeah, because my analyst was like, look, the type of woman you want to meet, not coming to your book signing. She's not going to be a fan. She might have read your stuff and liked it.
Right.
But she's not going after you.
Right.
Because she's going to assume you're this type of guy, which you have been for a long time.
Right.
And so, okay, got it. So I started doing the five things that my wife might be doing, future wife, that I loved but didn't do.
What were the five things?
CrossFit was one. Like, start actively going to entrepreneur groups. That's how I went to the group where I met Melissa, the woman who called me out, who started Book in a Box.
Okay.
There were like three or four other things. So
you took these actions proactively to meet the woman that you didn't know yet,
yes,
but was the kind of woman you wanted.
How the kind of woman would be doing one of these five things.
That is so smart.
Yeah. And I was right, but not the way I thought.
Mm.
I thought I would meet her at the events. I did not.
Mm.
What I realized was the kind of woman I wanted to meet was going to have a buffer around her because she's going to be really attractive. She's going to be high value and high status. It's not coming to me. I got to go get her. And so I didn't meet her at all. I mean, 6 months I'm doing all these things, didn't meet her. What I realized was what I was doing, and not with any plan, just unconsciously, I was auditioning to the circle of friends.
Yeah, in her network.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
That's exactly what I was doing.
Yep.
And that's exactly what happened. So I started doing CrossFit because, you know, I worked out before. I'm like, I don't need to go to CrossFit. It's cold. I can just deadlift on my own.
Right.
Which is true.
Right.
But I like CrossFit. It's fun. My coach is a woman, Jen Shaw. She runs Travis County Strength here now in Austin. Great. Cool as hell. Great CrossFit coach. She went to the CrossFit Games, finished like high up a couple times. She trains with a pretty elite group of CrossFitters in Austin. My wife was in the group she trained with.
Mm.
After Jen got to know me, Jen was in the military. Mm-hmm. So she had read my books for years, loved them, thought it was amazing. When I walked into her class, she was like, Tucker Max? And she was all like a fangirl. I thought, okay, great. And then she was like a total hard ass on me as a coach, right?
Right.
She was cool.
Right.
Anyway, so she knew my wife. And then once she invited me to some party she was having, I brought a girl I was kind of seeing at the time. And like the girl goes to the bathroom and Jen like grabs my arm. She's like, why did you bring this tramp to my party? Why are you dating her even?
Wow,
and I'm like,
nice.
What are you talking about? She's nice. And Jen's like, that girl's not good enough for you. I'm like, okay, Jen.
That's a huge compliment though, right?
It is. And so I was like, all right, Jen, introduce me to a girl who is. And she kind of looks at me and she goes, all right, I know one, but I don't know if you can handle her. And I was like, introduce me to the woman I can't handle.
Right, right.
So she introduced me to this 6 foot tall Viking who was literally in the game, or I had just qualified for regionals, who like looked like she, Veronica, you met Veronica.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She is no joke. She is like a Valkyrie.
Yes.
It was the female Viking.
Yes.
She's a Valkyrie.
Yes.
And like, and smart as hell. And I'm like, okay, but I'm also a badass in multiple ways. So okay.
I got you. Yeah.
Right. We can match up. And so we met, and then that's the rest isn't quite history. She didn't really like me at first, but I'll never, the reason I knew she was perfect is for me, not perfect, but for me. On our first date, I'd asked her a bunch of questions about herself. Like, not that probing, but like, sort of like you and Todd can be, right? Like, I got into her.
Yeah.
That's always what I do with women, like, because I want to see, like, what are they about, right?
Sure.
Instead of making dumbass small talk, I'm like, I just ask questions. But most people stop at one or two. I keep going until it gets uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And I just sit in the uncomfort and nothing offensive. Like, I'm not like, how many men have you slept with?
Right.
It's more just, you know, well, what was that like? Well, why'd you do that?
Exactly.
Well, what are you thinking? You know, whatever. And so we got into like stuff with her dad and you know, the conversation got there, but naturally, but we got into a little bit into it. And I just kept asking questions and she got super uncomfortable, like moving in her seat, like visibly, like all that kind of stuff. And didn't ask me to stop. Didn't tell me to like nothing like that, but just like comfortable. And so I didn't think she'd like me at all, whatever, but kept emailing, decided to go on a second date. And on the date, so after a couple of glasses of Chateaubriand, she tells me, she said, hey, you know, I know last time we hung out, you told me that you were doing therapy and you brought up some questions, some stuff that like was uncomfortable for me, but I knew I had to address it. And I just hadn't. And I think I want to go address it. Do you think you could refer me to your therapist or whoever else you know? And dude, I was gobsmacked. I have never in my whole life had a woman that like was like that asked for that.
That's
like,
amazing. Yeah.
That was that receptive and like,
vulnerable
and strong.
Yes.
And like, she wasn't, it wasn't about me. She like,
yeah,
at that point,
no,
I don't
she
think
like
she liked me that much. She was just like, she wanted help.
Right.
Like she, I asked questions. She's like, I want to go do it and I'm going to go. It wasn't about me. She's like, I'm going to go do it on my own. Right. I was like, okay, there's something here. This is amazing. And so then, like, that date went really well. And then it was kind of off to the races after that. That was when I realized she was,
that's so
she was
cool.
different, yeah.
And so you just, you made the decision to change, put yourself in the environment. That's about as designed a thing as I've heard for doing. That's pretty cool. And now you have a wonderful family. And
dude, amazing wife. Kid number three is on the way. And
that's awesome.
And, it's funny, man. Like, you know, you can't do counterfactuals. You can only play life one way.
Yep.
But I can so easily, I can almost feel it. Like I can so see a life where I didn't do that. I didn't meet her or a woman she can't be the only woman on earth who's this great for me. There's got to be, just, I don't believe the only one person for you, and that's nonsense, right?
I agree.
There might not be many, but but anyway, so I could imagine where I just decide, nah, I'm going to marry, two or three of the girls I dated before her were great. Mm-hmm. They were just kind of like the type that were in my orbit and saw me as an object. And they
might exactly what you're talking about. I had the same exact thing.
I could have easily married one of them. And I feel like my life would be totally different, not a little bit different, like radically different.
Orders of magnitude.
Right, I would have had kids with the wrong woman. It would have eventually, this bacteria would have grown and created sepsis, and it would have caused a divorce. And no fault of either of us as people, just like it. And my life would have been radically different, man. And people always ask me, like, how do you have such a great marriage? I'm like, I married the right woman, and then that's 90% of it, if not more.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, the right woman for me, right? The right person for you, man or woman, whatever you are. It's like, that's 90% of it, at least. But then that requires some self-awareness and some work. But dude, when you hit it right, it becomes like a force multiplier.
Let's go. What's next? Are you looking down the future, the 10-year from now, Tucker, or anything like that?
And so now it's all about Scribe and the stuff we're doing within Scribe and that mission and helping people write their books and spread their knowledge. Like, Todd's a great example. Mm-hmm. Alter Ego Effect is going to change so many lives, right? We help make that happen. Your book, you got at least two, probably more. They're going to have material impacts on a lot of people, right? So, like, I can't write that book, but I can help you get it out, right?
Does it feel good helping?
Oh, dude, it's amazing.
Create that change in the world and that.
All right. So, you know what I always tell my people, like a tribe? Like, we call ourselves a tribe. It's Scribe Tribe. It's like kind of goofy, but they love it.
It works.
What I always tell them is, I like the authors we work with, most of them. Books are cool. But honestly, to hell with them. That's not why we do this. Mm-hmm. We do not. We do not do it for the money they pay us or for them. If we want to really see why we do this, go read the reviews on Amazon. That is why we do it.
Yeah.
Right? And so, like, I have a slide deck where I'm like, go look at Driven. Look at the review for that book. And dude's like, I was going to kill myself.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the book's about ADHD and how to, like, understand it and harness it and whatever. Doug Brackman has probably saved 100, 200 people, literally saved their lives, forgetting the people's lives he's transformed, right? You know, he had horrible ADHD, figured out what. Go look at the reviews on Tiffany Haddish's book.
Mm-hmm.
And look at how many 16-year-old black girls write things like, I didn't know that people could get out. I didn't know this was possible. Yeah. I didn't know there was anything better
for
me.
That's so great that you do that yourself and that you tell your team to do that.
That's what we do.
Not many businesses do you get to so publicly and easily see the impact that you're having.
Right.
That's
exactly.
A really cool thing about that business.
I always tell them, focus on the reader. That's ultimately who we're serving. And what that does is that really helps us make better books and frame. And then everything we frame to the author is, okay, look, like I'll tell you, you're going to hear this in the process if you haven't already heard it. We're going to hurt your feelings before we let you publish a bad book.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is not even because we want you to look good. We do. We want you to look good because we want the reader to benefit.
Yeah.
If the reader benefits, everybody wins.
Absolutely. I love it. So awesome to spend time with you. As always, we're going to do the wine one in part two.
Yes.
And thanks for taking the time to chat.
Of course. My pleasure.
You've been listening to Business Lunch with Roland Frazier. For more information, go to businesslunchpodcast.com. Thank you for listening.